please the court. I also like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Glenn Goldman, registration number 24878. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Tolbert. This case, as you know, after reading the briefs, involves step-parent adoption. In this case, this involves the due process rights of my client, Mr. Tolbert, whose rights were violated based upon the improper notice that was allegedly given to him. In this case, in a step-parent adoption, before the court can terminate someone's parental rights, they have to be given proper notice of the hearing. And that notice also has to be proven by a proper affidavit of service. And in this case, that proper affidavit of service was not supplied to the court. The court had insufficient evidence to establish that notice was given on Mr. Tolbert. The case and the evidence does not support that he was provided proper notice. If you look in the record, let me grab that. The record demonstrates that the notice that was given to the court, or the actual affidavit of service, is just a handwritten, scrawled note by a Ms. Anderson. And in there's no indication of what Mr. Tolbert was given. There's only an indication that a copy of court paper. There's no indication that he was given a notice of hearing, giving him the time of the hearing and what issues were going to be addressed. Mr. Tolbert has never stated that he has received proper notice or service in this case.
I'm sorry, counsel, but I thought the record indicated in one of his pleadings to the trial court that he acknowledged in August that the day after the hearing he had to enforce parental rights in what you refer to as the juvenile court, he acknowledged knowing that there was a petition for step-parent adoption.
No, he does not acknowledge that. What he does say is that the following. He does indicate that he received motions, and he says he received motions in the mail. There was no motion in the adoption case. And the other side has never asserted that they mailed him anything regarding the notice of the October 16th hearing. The other side is asserting that they had him served through Ms. Anderson. So there's no indication that he's received anything. And at this time, he's acting pro se. He's writing. He doesn't know exactly what's going on. There's no evidence that he was served that notice at all in any of his pleadings.
But wasn't there a supplementation to the original notice of service?
There was a supplementation. And again, that supplementation is still inappropriate and not sufficient because we're dealing with the fundamental liberty interest in this case, the fundamental right the parent to be the father of his son. And what they tried to do was, after the fact, try to establish what was apparently given to him apparently by this Ms. Anderson. And if you look at the supplement, what they tried to supplement, they still don't know what papers or documents were provided. There's no indication by Ms. Anderson, if she even gave anything to him, what was provided. There's no one has any knowledge as to what they allege Mr. Tolbert was given, if he was given anything. The proper service is to have an affidavit certified as to the manner of service, what was provided, so that the court knows, was this person properly served? We're going to hear whether his parental rights should be terminated. We want to make sure he has proper notice, and they didn't provide that. And also, the rule allows you can supplement unless there's not prejudice to the party. The prejudice in this case is severe because what they're trying to do is terminate his parental rights so that he can't see his son anymore.
So it seems to me that, separate and aside from the service issue, you're effectively accusing the potential adoptive father of committing fraud or misrepresentation on the court. And
absolutely.
What support is there in the record of an intent to defraud or make misrepresentations to the adoption court?
To the adoption court, there is... To the adoption court, there is the petition that they filed for step-parent adoption that alleges that Mr. Tolbert had abandoned his child for over a year. In the motion that was filed by Mr. Tolbert to set aside the court's order, he specifically says, I have not abandoned my son. In fact, I had parental visitation enforced 2 months earlier by another court. That in the record establishes that he was enforcing and visiting his son immediately before this adoption hearing took place. This isn't a case where someone abandoned their son. This is a case where someone has, and it's in the record, that he had seen his son, and his parental rights were enforced when the other side, when the mother tried to say, you know, that his parenting time should be restricted.
Let me ask you this. This wasn't brief, but it occurred to me that, you know, obviously if he had been represented by counsel, this adoptive stepfather, he had been represented by counsel, counsel would have had a duty to correct any misstatements or, you know, whether they were intentional or unintentional misstatements of fact. As pro se's, what duties did the mother and then the adoptive father have to inform the court if circumstances had changed?
I think, not even if they had changed, but at the time they filed the petition, they knew, and they had a duty of candor under Rule 16.2, which I think applies to all parties, and anyone appearing in front of the court to be honest about the facts and what's going on, that an obligation to tell the court that there was another proceeding held 2 months earlier when the adoptive, or when the father had his parenting time enforced and was visiting his son. They have a duty to be honest with the court as the facts being tried by that court, because they know that they're trying to adopt someone based upon abandonment, and they should know that they cannot lie to the court, especially when you're involving someone's fundamental right to their child.
Let me ask you a question about the record. As I understand it, the trial court didn't really make any findings on this fraud issue. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So the question that I have then is this a matter that we can decide as a matter of law, or is this something that if we were to agree with you, we should send it back to the trial court, I guess, to hold a hearing on, an evidentiary hearing on what was said, what wasn't said, and whether it was fraudulent or not? Can you help me out there a little bit?
That's an interesting question, too, because it could be twofold. Some of the cases, like the most recent case that was just decided by this court, it's in the petition of CLS and Lutheran Family Services. In that case, there was undisputed evidence that there was fraud in the step-parent adoption. In that case, the mother had alleged that the child had died, and therefore the father didn't even know that he had a child anymore. He lied to the court in the adoption. Obviously, the child wasn't dead. They had the adoption. And in that case, it was undisputed that she had committed a fraud on the court. And in this, and they said, you don't have to hold a hearing when it's obvious that fraud has been committed. And in this case, in all the briefings that have been submitted and all the pleadings that have been submitted, the other side has never disputed the fact that the father did not abandon the child for over a year. Every time we've asserted that he's had parenting time, he's been with the child within the last year, they've never disputed that. So in this case, you could arguably say, look, it's undisputed that there was fraud. We're going to find the order granting the step-parent adoption void. On the other hand, there's also the discretion saying, look, the minute that the issue of fraud was brought up, that's a factual matter. We need to get it back to the trial court for the judge who refused to look at it, to take a look at it and determine if there was fraud going on in this step-parent adoption. Mm-hmm. The other issue that's involved in this case, in addition to the notice and the fraud, is also the jurisdictional arguments that have been made by appellant. When you have a court that is involved in the parental allocation of a child, that court has ongoing jurisdiction over that child. And the purpose of allowing that court and having that court have ongoing jurisdiction is to prevent inconsistent orders. And that's exactly what happened in this case. This adoption court did not have the jurisdiction to hear this case because the other court in the same courthouse and judge had jurisdiction over this matter. They had jurisdiction to determine parental responsibility. In fact, they did it 2 months earlier. And what should have happened in this case is when the judge, if he would have looked at the court records and asked some questions, would have seen, hey, wait a minute, there's another proceeding going on that just happened 2 months ago.
But wait a minute, is that a duty that you're saying the court itself had, or is that a duty that the opposing side had to advise the court?
I think the opposing side had to, but I also think in a case like this, I think the judge had a duty to ask questions regarding a couple of things. One, what other proceedings have gone on in this case, any? What about paternity? Has that been determined? Where's the father? Why isn't he here? Regarding the notice, the judge didn't even check off on the on the order that he, that proper notice was given.
But is that really a question of subject matter jurisdiction? I mean, here you have a, this district court had, certainly had the power and authority under the statute to hear these kinds of cases. Why isn't that the end of it?
Because I think it's a jurisdiction over the matter and the parties. I think statute 19-1-1044 addresses this, and it's jurisdiction over to hear the matter and the parties when another court is entering orders regarding that child. And that statute, in the case of JAV 206 Pacific 3rd, goes through what should happen. When another court has jurisdiction over the matters and the parties, that court should not hear the case. They need to get the cases either consolidated, or that other court needs to certify the issues to one court so that one court is aware of everything and making all the decisions.
Axel, in the JAV, the courts knew, they were aware of the other court. Here, there's no indication that the adoption court had any idea that was going on in the parenting court.
And that's the problem.
Right.
That's the problem, because they didn't know. And had they been told and been advised, we wouldn't be here today.
Then what the district court, when people appear before them and testify under oath that the child's been abandoned for a year, and it's in the best interest of the child. You're saying then that the trial court has some sort of duty to pursue, tell me about the background? I mean, you've got an affidavit from the stepfather and the mother,
right,
plus their testimony. I know it was a brief hearing, but to place a burden on the trial court to do something at that time, what authority is there for that?
I think JAV and the other case that was cited by the appellant indicates that there is a duty by the trial court to make sure also that the child's available for adoption, and before they proceed, make sure that there's not a proceeding under this statute that another court has already, is already managing the allocation responsibilities for that child. So I think the court has an obligation to see what else has been going on with this child before they terminate the parental rights. And
so you're a little less than 3 minutes now if you wanted to save some time for rebuttal.
Okay. Also, just regarding the excusable neglect, father never admitted to receiving service. That was an alternative argument made in the motion by the counsel that he had. Never said that he got notice, alternative argument. And under the case of Goodman, there are a number of factors that the trial court should have considered before they ruled on that, on the excusable neglect argument. And one of those is whether the appellant had a meritorious defense to the claim. And in this case, he did, because he had not abandoned his son. And I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman.
At this court, Howard Beck on behalf of the Huffs. I'd like to introduce to the court our my co-counsel, our associate, Mr. Michael Maglieri. If you like our papers, give him the credit. If you don't like him, I'll take the blame. But this is his first appellate case. Let me pick up, if it's okay with the court, where appellant just left off. The predicate standard for whether or not there's been abandonment is not the day before the hearing. It's not the month before the hearing. It's the year before the petition for abandonment and the petition to adopt is filed. And there's cases that we've cited in our supplemental authority that say that. Now, the court may ask, well, why? I think the answer is pretty obvious. If you tell a parent that, you know, if you allege that they've abandoned their child and it's 60, 90 days before the hearing, what's going to happen in that 90 days? Well, if the parent doesn't want to find that there's an abandonment, the parent's going to start seeing his child. The parent's going to start supporting his child, even though he may not have done it for years. The relevant predicate period is not that Mr. Tolbert was having parenting time with his child a month before, a week before.
But it's not irrelevant, is it?
It's not irrelevant, but what he was doing, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
I guess what I'm saying is, I mean, quite candidly, I'm troubled by this fraud allegation. At least I'm troubled by the fact that the trial court didn't make any findings about it. So, I mean, I hear everything you're saying, and you may be right, but isn't that something that the trial court should have heard evidence and decided whether there was a fraud on the court or not?
There was never anything, there is nothing in the record to indicate any allegation of fraud until after this appeal was briefed. It just didn't happen. I mean, the most you've got, I mean, after all, Mr. Tolbert didn't show up on October 16th for the adoption and termination of parental rights. He says he was confused. I believe he just didn't bother to go. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, in the post-judgment matter, though, that he filed, didn't he bring to the court's attention these facts, allegations?
No. All he says in his Rule 60B, Rule 60B has three pieces to it. He had assistance of counsel at the time, Mr. Dwyer. Not actively, but Mr. Dwyer, under 11B or whatever it is, assisted him. His 60B motion references subsection 1 and subsection 3, which is the judgment's void or excusable neglect. It doesn't even mention fraud. There's nothing in the 60B motion that speaks to fraud. In other words, there's nothing that would give Judge Sylvester the opportunity to say, well, wait a minute here. All he says is, I didn't abandon my child. That's the five words in there that relate to the possibility that there was fraud. All right, let's talk about that. 60B motion. I always thought that fraud had to be alleged with specificity. It's not alleged at all. Number two, the 60B motion isn't verified. There's no, even though Mr. Tolbert's represented by counsel at the time, there's no separate affidavit. And as Chief Judge Davidson found when they tried to supplement the record in this case, not only with the record from the 04 paternity case, this all started in 1904 as a paternity case. So when it, to the extent people make it sound like that there were things going on or cases being filed in the Arapahoe County District Court weeks or months before, it was an ongoing dispute. Been going on for 6 years. Part of that time, Mr. Tolbert was admittedly, as he states in his 60B motion, in the Department of Corrections. Part of the time, there was arguing over parenting time and support. But it seems to me that if Mr. Tolbert wanted to allege fraud, he had at least two, and certainly the Rule 60B motion, and he chose not to.
Let me ask you a question about that. Is it your position that this, whether or not the word 60B2 were expressly used in the 60B motion, is it your position that the substance of that motion and the filings regarding it did not substantively raise the factual issue of fraud on the court?
That is absolutely our position, Your Honor.
Okay.
It raises two issues. One, inadequate service, which I think everybody understands by now. There may have been a technical defect. The cases say if there's a technical defect in service, you can correct that technical defect. That was done. Secondly, the record shows that Mr. Tolbert got a notice of the hearing on October 16th directly from the court. I believe it's page 16 in the record. He also got the same document from Ms. Huff when she gave them to his parole officer, who then gave all of the documents, the two petitions, the notice of hearing, the affidavit of abandonment, to Mr. Tolbert. When there was a question of, well, what documents did she give him, because you're dealing with people that were pro se on both sides at this point, sir.
Does the motion raise an issue on the question of abandonment, though? Does the motion say, hey, they told you that I abandoned my child, I didn't do that?
The motion says, I did not abandon my child, period. Does not allege fraud, does not contradict. I mean, I think it's important that the petition to adopt, the petition to relinquish parental rights is under oath. Those petitions are under oath. The 60B motion could have been supported by a separate affidavit, wasn't. Nothing. Mr. Tolbert's signature doesn't appear on there. It appears on there, but it's not under oath. Basically, the predicate standard that I think you have to have if you're going to allege fraud is just missing.
Mr. Beck,
yeah.
I understand that your law firm was not involved in the actual filing the adoption petition and the affidavit that accompanied that petition. Mm-hmm. But between the time that that petition was filed and the time that the parties appeared at the hearing on the adoption proceeding, there were new facts. Those new facts were not presented, or there was additional information that would have been useful for the court to know, namely what happened in the juvenile court proceeding, the 04 case. We are troubled by the fact that that information was not shared with the adoption court. Is it your position that because they were pro se, they had no duty to update the court with new information, with additional information? What's your response to that?
My response is simple. Mr. Tolbert gets released from Department of Corrections around July 1st. July 17th, the Huffs file the petition for to relinquish parental rights, to terminate parental rights, and petition for adoption. In that same time period, actually shortly thereafter, on August, I think, 14th, Mr. Huff and Mr. Tolbert, for probably the 10th time, went before Magistrate Yoder because Mr. Tolbert wanted hearing time. And he got it. He got it. That's all in the 04 case. And he, you know, so the Huffs, I mean, Ms. Huff, and now the adopted father, Mr. Huff, you know, are they to disobey an order of the from Magistrate Yoder? Of course not. They allowed Mr. Tolbert to have parenting time with his son. But again, if you're going to, you know, almost every one of these cases is going to have either a paternity case or a dissolution of marriage behind it. You know, you've got kids, unless they're newborns, what you're going to have is you're going to have some order from some court, either through paternity or through dissolution, saying, here's when you can see your child or children, and here's how you support your child or children.
And wouldn't that be relevant to the adoption court?
It is relevant for the one-year period prior to when they file the petition. Well, the cases, there are two cases, and they're cited in our supplemental authorities, Your Honor, that say the relevant time period is, and I think there's a good reason for it, is the 1 year before you file the affidavit, not between when the affidavit is filed and when you have a hearing. Because if you do it that way, there's never going to be an adoption. There's never going to be a termination of parental rights. For any parent who wants to step in and say, oh, you got a hearing in 90 days? Yeah, maybe I haven't seen my child or supported my child or anything like that. Now, all of a sudden, they run right out and do it.
And we don't know here whether those are the facts or not. Neither did the trial court.
And neither do I. And neither do I. But we do know, well, the allegations in the two petitions are under oath. Mr. Tolbert has never, prior to the time that this appeal got up and running, has never alleged fraud. That was only alleged when Mr. Tolbert, through counsel, started attempting to supplement the record. They've now tried four times. Three times in front of this court and one time in front of the Colorado Supreme Court.
But even if he doesn't use the word fraud or use the word misrepresentation, he's effectively telling even the trial court that the facts are incorrect, that there was no abandonment. I mean, he's saying you've got the facts wrong.
If it's enough to say I did not abandon my child, which is all you'll find in the 60B motion, if that's enough, without alleging the fraud subsection, with assistance of counsel, not by himself now, if fraud isn't alleged, fraud was never even mentioned until the appeal got up and running. It was not an issue. I mean, Mr. Tolbert says I got confused and didn't show up. Fine, I'll concede that. Yes, sir.
I saw under the supplemental authority that was cited on case CLS.
Yes.
Does that opinion state that if you specify one ground under 60B, it does not preclude relief under another clause when supported by other allegations?
You know, I'm not trying to hang too much on 60B2 because that's the fraud section.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that fraud was not alleged. There's two ways it could have been alleged, Your Honor. One is by citing that portion of Rule 60B. The other way was to say there was fraud. Neither was done. The issue of service, I think, is clearly there was good service. you know, what I'm perplexed by is that if you're going to allege, either, even if you just allege I didn't abandon my child, shouldn't you at least do it under oath? Shouldn't there be something, some predicate that says, and here's why? The only thing he didn't do with this, and again,
well, let me stop you there for a little bit, because you've mentioned that a couple of times. Is there anything in the rule or the cases that say if you file a motion under 60B, it has to be under oath?
No, but if you're going to allege fraud, and the thing you're alleging is outside the record, I think what you've got to do is provide the requisite affidavit, which...
Where in the rule does it say that?
Affidavits have to be under oath?
No, not that affidavits have to be under oath.
Okay.
Where in the rule does it say you have to submit an affidavit with your motion?
With the Rule 60 motion?
Yes.
It doesn't say that. But if you're going to allege something outside of the record, it seems to me the cases clearly state that you have two choices. Well, three if you want to include the one that was exercised here, which is do nothing. A second choice is, and Chief Judge Davidson pointed this out in one of her preliminary orders, she said, if Mr. Tolbert, in the 60B motion, asked the court to take judicial notice of the record in the 04 case, then she would consider reconsidering her denial of the motion to supplement the record. That stopped right there. There was nothing that happened after that. So that's another alternative. Mr. Tolbert didn't propose that or suggest that on the October 16th, 09 hearing because he wasn't there. But he did have a chance to do it in 60. The third choice is, if you're going to want to bring into the record things that are not in the record, which is exactly what he was trying to do, when he said he hadn't abandoned his child, is give the court an affidavit. Ask the court to take judicial notice. Do something.
Can't we ourselves take judicial notice of the fact that there was that other proceeding?
Yeah, you have been asked to take judicial notice of it already. There are a variety of, and I'm sure it's in the record, but there's in the record in the appeal where Mr. Tolbert has tried several times to supplement the record. The problem with that is you get his side of the record. He says, here are the documents that I think you ought to look at from the 04 proceeding. Not all the documents, just, you know, and frankly, if I was in his shoes or it was reversed, I'd probably say the same thing. This court has denied three times the attempt to do that.
I want to ask, if I file a 60B2 motion,
yes,
and I say it's under 60B, let's say I say it's under 60B2, and I make all kinds of allegations of fraud, and I make an argument, but I don't give you an affidavit, don't give the court an affidavit, I don't verify it, I just file the motion, and I say, here it is, this is my side of the case, I want a hearing.
I think you'd be entitled under that scenario to a hearing. The alternative is if you ask the court to take judicial notice of the earlier case. I think that would entitle you to a hearing. But when there's nothing within the framework of the 60B motion that indicates there's anything outside of it.
The issue is what's in the 60B motion, substantively, correct?
Yes, sir. And there are two grounds alleged.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Goodman, you've got a little less than 2 minutes for rebuttal, I think.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, the opposing counsel indicates that the notice of hearing was allegedly mailed to Mr. Tolbert. If you take a look at page 16 of the record, there is a notice of hearing, and the only person that's identified on that certificate is the petitioner, not Mr. Tolbert. Again, Mr. Tolbert was not provided notice of the hearing. Nothing was mailed to him. And the other side also indicated that somehow he's focusing on this one-year time period, that it's the 1 year from when the petition was filed. Well, since he's referring to the other court and the other proceedings, the affidavit that was filed by the mother was to restrict Mr. Tolbert's parenting time. He was exercising the parenting time, and it was filed to restrict his parenting time. And in the affidavit by the mother, she says that Mr. Tolbert had visited his son in September of 2008 and December of 2008. And that's if they want to use the
What in the record is that affidavit?
That's in the supplementation that was stricken. We tried to supplement the record by the documents from the other proceeding and ask this court to take judicial notice of those proceedings.
And it, what docket entry is it in the in the 04 case?
It's the affidavit in support of motion to modify allocation of parental responsibilities. It was filed on August 5th of 09, and it indicates that it's the basis of her motion to restrict the parenting time, and she says, quote, this occurred between the times of September 2008 and December 2008.
As of right now, that's not in our record, correct?
It hasn't been accepted in the record. It was filed with this court, but it was...
It's not in the record.
Right. The court refused to accept it, correct. And that's it. I know my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course.